Six.
I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama signed a presidential memorandum last Thursday directing the Labor Department to revise the rules for overtime pay. Here's his explanation for taking this action.
Unfortunately, today, millions of Americans aren't getting the extra pay they deserve. And that's because an exception that was originally meant for high-paid, white-collar employees now covers workers earning as little as $23,000, $660 a year. So if you're making $23,000, you know, typically you're not high in management, right? If your salary is even a dollar above the current threshold, you may not be guaranteed overtime. It doesn't matter if what you do is mostly physical work like stocking shelves. It doesn't matter if you're working 50 or 60 or 70 hours a week. Your employer doesn't have to pay you a single extra dime.
Obama said that was wrong and wants the Labor Department to raise the salary cap that has not kept up with inflation. Corporations and business organizations were nearly unanimous in their criticism of the president's decision. We begin our conversation with Damian Paletta, who covers economic policy for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. And Damian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What kind of jobs was the president talking about? These manager white collar jobs that are paid in, you know, $23,000, $24,000.
So we're probably talking about people like assistant managers at convenience stores, retail stores, restaurants, even journalists for that matter. So these are people who aren't maybe the top executive, obviously, at a company, but they're not an entry level position, but still they might be in a position where they're only making, you know, $450 a week. And, you know, those, when you're making a salary like that, it might not seem like a lot of money, but you can have big hour demands on your job. It might be a 50-hour a week job, you know, 5 or 6 days a week. So there are, we believe there are plenty of people who fit into this camp.
Do we know how many people fit into this camp?
No, we know that about 20% of full-time salaried workers make less than $455 a week. We also know, though, you know, hourly paid workers, of which there's probably 50 or 60 million workers, 75% of those get overtime each year because they work more than 40 hours a week. So it's much easier to get overtime if you're paid by the hour than if you're paid a salary because of, you know, this kind of technical rule that the president was describing.
And we're really talking about people who are described as managers or assistant managers or white-collar workers or executives. Does it also apply to, quote-unquote, non-managers?
I think it depends on how the job is classified, and quite frankly, it's a little bit ambiguous in the rule to make it a little bit harder for people to qualify for overtime. So right now, I mean, it's virtually impossible if you're salaried to get overtime because so few people make, you know, below a salary below that $455 a week. So the rule's kind of squishy, quite frankly, and what the president wants to do is clarify and broaden who would qualify for benefits or would qualify for overtime, and that's where he's going to run into this kind of battle with a lot of business groups who think that this is just going to potentially cut off access to jobs for a lot of Americans.
Yeah, and what is the pushback coming from the business community?
Well, I think they're trying to see, you know, one of the interesting things is the White House has directed the Department of Labor to write this rule. He hasn't told them exactly how he wants it written. So right now the hourly or the dollar limit for weekly wages is $455 a week. If you make more than that, you it's very difficult to get overtime. The president wants that to be increased, but how much will they increase it? Some want it to be doubled so that you can make about $50,000 a year and still qualify for benefits. Now, maybe the Labor Department will go for, you know, try to split the difference, maybe put it at like $750 a week. We don't know. So I think the business community in particular sectors, you know, the restaurant industry, retail industry, they're probably going to wait to see exactly how this thing is crafted before they decide how to potentially battle it.
And it looks like there is a consultation period. The Labor Department or even Labor Secretary Thomas Perez consulting with workers, I guess, consulting with business. Is this generally the way an idea like this goes ahead in Washington?
That's exactly right. It's kind of technical. What they do is they end up, the Labor Department will propose a rule and then give, you know, the public maybe 30 to 60 days to comment on it. Then they'll, you know, kind of go through all the different feedback they get and make a final decision. What's interesting about this, you know, the president said in the State of the Union that he's going to have to, because you know, there's not going to be any real new laws passed by Congress because there's such division in Washington right now. He wants to focus on these sort of administrative things that he can do that he thinks will help workers get more money. So this is one of those examples. But it's not something that will expire at the end of his term. This is a policy change that will endure until the next president decides to make a change. You know, so we're currently living under the rules in 2004 that President George W. Bush set, and President Obama wants to put his own stamp on this specific part of labor law.
But it seems this salary cap has been raised over the years. It's not unusual to raise it, yes?
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, the salary cap has been in place for decades, and it can be raised. Not only can a salary cap be raised, but the definition of who gets these overtime, who qualifies for overtime, can be changed as well. You know, what's the definition of a white-collar worker?
Right.
Who is management? Who isn't management? Those are the sorts of things that can also be changed. And that's why I think a lot of workers and a lot of business groups are going to be watching closely to see what the Labor Department does. It's not just going to be, you know, what changes are made to this dollar amount. It's also going to be, you know, whose jobs might be included and whose would not be.
Does it raise questions about the 40-hour work week? Does that become an issue at stake here?
You know, there's been a lot of focus on the work week in the past few months, both because of the health care law and because Americans, you know, because wages are not really going up. You know, how much do Americans have to work in order to get ahead? And I think this brings a more focus on the 40-hour work week. You know, we're at a position in this country's economic history where more and more families, you know, you have two spouses working, they're probably spending less time at home with the kids, less time to do all sorts of things that it takes to, you know, get a household moving, get the kids fed, get, you know, things going. And so there's a lot more strain on the family. And I think what the president's trying to reflect here is that, you know, people want to be compensated for the extra work that they might be doing. And what the, you know, with the unemployment rate where it is, you know, it's coming down, but not that quickly. It's hard for workers to sort of demand more flexibility and possibly demand more pay in exchange for their additional work, because employers can find all sorts of willing bodies, you know, out there looking for jobs. So it's an interesting point, you know, 5 years after the recession to try to have this conversation, but it's very difficult for a lot of workers who just are glad to have a job, glad to have any income, to be making sort of new demands on their employer about increasing their overtime pay.
And again, that's Damian Paletta. He covers economic policy for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau, getting us started as we talk about this executive order coming from the president last week, directing the Labor Department to take a look at the overtime pay for people that are called managers and whether they would become eligible for time and a half pay when they put in extra hours. This is another sort of workaround, I guess, that the president is doing with Congress. What has been the response, especially from the Republicans, the idea that the president would use this executive authority or presidential memorandum to get some action on this issue?
Well, the response has not been positive. I think they also want to wait and see how the rule is crafted, you know, before they really make a sort of targeted criticism. One of the things we have heard from Republicans clearly is that, you know, there should be more focus from the White House on creating jobs and not just boosting the pay of people who already have jobs. You know, let's get some policies in place that will get more Americans working, get those people who are out of the labor market, who are unemployed, who are underemployed, into better jobs, instead of proposing policies that business groups say, you know, could potentially lead to fewer jobs. If they have to pay one person more money, then they might not hire more. You know, that's kind of the argument we've heard from them on things like the minimum wage as well. So that's the kind of stuff we're expecting. That's the dynamic of the argument we're expecting as this process moves along the regulatory, you know, train tracks. And, you know, quite frankly, it could take probably a year for this whole thing to be, you know, sorted out and up and running. But that's the sort of thing we're hearing right now.
Does anyone defend the idea of someone working, let's say, 60 hours a week and getting paid $24,000?
I would think no. I think a lot of the things we hear from business groups might be, you know, this is, I don't want to say a rite of passage, but this is kind of the process. You know, you work your tail off, you know, when you're younger and do more hours for less pay, and then you get in a position, you prove yourself, and you get into a higher paying job. Maybe you become that management official that you were kind of striving for, and that's kind of how you make ends meet. But yeah, I mean, it's probably not the sign of the healthiest economy if that's the price people have to pay just to have a $23,000 a week job, a year job, is if they have to work 60 hours, not spend much time with their family, and you know, make those sorts of sacrifices.
And this is an issue that really goes back decades to the 1930s, yeah?
That's right. I mean, of course, a lot of labor law was set, you know, in the 1930s, in the wake of the Great Depression. That's when we had the implementation of the minimum wage and some other things like that. Child labor laws as well had some big reforms. So, you know, this is the kind of thing, obviously, when you put a dollar amount, like $455 on any sort of policy, it's going to have to be revisited over time as wages go up and as, you know, all sorts of changes in the workforce take place. And so this is the sort of thing that the White House is trying to do. You know, should they change? Should they raise the $455 weekly limit? And also, should they redefine what kind of worker should be exempted from overtime rules? So those are the two different things that are going to get a close look. You know, the question is the White House going to try to expedite this, get it moving quickly so that the president can show some real results, or is this going to get bogged down in kind of a regulatory back and forth and maybe take much longer?
And has anyone run the numbers, whether this number of 455 a week, has that kept up with inflation? Is that behind the inflation?
It hasn't kept up with inflation for sure. And the question is, you know, how far behind is it? I think, some liberal economists believe that if you raise it to, if you raise it from $455 to around $970 a week, as I mentioned, it's around $50,000 a year in salary, you would allow 5 to 10 million more people to get overtime benefits each year. You know, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of people. And so the question is, would those people, if they got more money, would they spend that back into the economy? Would that kind of help the economy grow? Would businesses end up benefiting instead from possibly being hurt by having to pay more in salary? Those are the sorts of things that we're going to hear both sides argue out. But it depending on how they structure it, it could potentially help a lot more people get a big raise.
In fact, we're going to hear that debate argued out in just a couple of minutes before we say, right after we say goodbye to you, Damien. Assuming the Labor Secretary Thomas Perez comes up with a number, what happens next? Does that become the law?
Yeah, it would essentially become the law of the land. And now what's going to be really interesting, and what you should press your guests on, because you have great guests, and this is the big issue, is now let's say I'm making $23,000 a year, or let's say I'm making $40,000 a year, and my employer decides to lower my salary so that to $30,000 a year, and then they're going to give me $10,000 a year in overtime, right? So I end up still making the same amount of money that I was making anyway.
Right.
You know, there's easy ways to sort of rejigger someone's salary in order to not increase the cost of wages, but to sort of put this expectation or this demand on a worker that they have to work overtime in order to get what they were getting before. So the question is that kind of stuff going to take place? Is that how businesses tend to respond to this sort of thing? Or is it going to end up being a net increase in the salary for workers? That's the big question we're going to have to see. Maybe it depends, in retail jobs, maybe it happens more frequently than in restaurant jobs or in journalism jobs. I don't know, but that's the big question, and that's going to determine what the impact of this really is.
Well, I'm stealing that question from you, Damien, and I will put it to our two guests. Thank you very much for getting us started today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too. And that's Damien Poletta. He covers economic policy for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. And yes, we have two guests waiting in the wings. We're talking about overtime pay. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol abuse? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Steve, let me ask you something. When you're hosting NPR's Morning Edition, how do you keep all those news stories straight in your head?
By listening. I don't pretend to know all the answers. My job is to know who to ask and how to ask them. At NPR's Morning Program, our job is to push for real stories, honest answers.
And you can listen with us on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY. This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. If you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes on our show, here's your chance to find out. On a special Fresh Air broadcast, Friday, March 28th, our producers and I will answer your questions about how we put the show together. To submit your questions, go to the website whyy.org/askfreshair. That's whyy.org/askfreshair. So tell us what you want to know, then tune in March 28th.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and just to recap, last week President Obama directed the Labor Department to update federal rules on overtime pay, rules that apply to managers and supervisors who make about $455 a week. That's a little more than $23,000 a year and can't get overtime even if they work overtime. And joining us now are Ross Eisenbray, Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute, where his work focuses on labor issues. And Ross Eisenbray, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is James Shirk. He's senior policy analyst in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation, where he researches ways to promote competition and mobility in the workforce, joining us from their studios. And James Shirk, nice to have you with us on Radio Times today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And James, let me begin with you. And I put to you a question I put to Damian Paletta right before the break. Is there any justification for paying someone, let's say, $23,000, $24,000 a year and not paying them overtime if they work 40, 50, 60 hours a week?
You know, I think the notion of updating the rules is perfectly sensible. The notion of raising that threshold of $24,000, it was last increased by the Bush administration in 2004. And so if all they're saying is let's update it for inflation since 2004, I don't think there's going to be much opposition to the proposal. What I think has a lot of people concerned is the idea that you'd say that any employee who makes less than about $50,000 a year, is what Ross's organization has suggested, has to be paid overtime no matter what the job duties are. And the concern with that is you're effectively turning everyone who makes less than that into an hourly employee who has to track their hours. And when you're talking about things like the flexibility to work from home, telecommuting, and the like, basically anyone, if you've got that higher threshold, who makes less than that couldn't do that.
Well,
and that's the concern.
Okay, and I want to pick up on all of that, but what do you think the threshold should be? And then I'll turn to Ross Eisenbray.
Yeah, I think if you update it for inflation, so it's somewhere around, say, you know, $30,000 a year, I think that's a fair threshold that's not going to have too many adverse economic effects. If you're talking about something like $50,000 a year, then I think you're going to have a lot of harmful effects in terms of just making employers less flexible with how many salaried workers can do their jobs.
Would you be comfortable with $40,000 a year?
No, I think, I mean, the thing here, you've got a three-part test. One, the worker has to be salaried. So if they're an hourly worker, they're automatically always going to qualify for overtime. Secondly, they have to have sufficiently advanced job duties. And thirdly, they have to be earning above whatever this new threshold is. Right. And I think if you're going to say that anyone everywhere in the United States has to be tracking their hours and you're keeping track basically to the minute of what they're doing, and it can't adopt the more flexible work arrangements that have become more and more popular with the many salaried employees, where you can work from home, where you're getting paid for the work done. Anyone who makes less than $40,000 a year can't do that. I think that would be pretty harmful.
Let me turn to you, Ross Eisenbray. I know you have a lot to respond to. But what do you think the threshold should be, and why?
Well, we proposed $50,000. Jared Bernstein from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and I proposed a level about $50,000 a year, because that actually is the low end of where the threshold was set in the 1960s and 70s. In fact, in the Ford administration, the Republican administration in 1975, they set it at what would be today a little more than $51,000 a year. And we thought if it was good enough back then in an economy that was much less productive and where the wealth of the nation was much less than it is today, if we could afford to pay people for overtime when they were making $1,000 a week back then, essentially, we could do it today.
And what kind of workers are we talking about? We're talking about salaried workers, so we should include that. And as James was saying, we're talking about people with, I guess, advanced job abilities and requirements. Who are we talking about from your perspective, Ross?
Well, we actually aren't just talking about those people. we're talking about dietary assistant, dietary manager in a nursing home. We're talking about people who spend most of the day washing dishes or serving other customers, but because they have a tiny amount of supervisory responsibility, as little as 20 or 30 minutes a day when they might have to say something about how their coworkers are working, that would be enough to make them a supervisor and therefore an executive under the rules that we have today, and they could be exempted from overtime pay. It's not what was originally contemplated when the law was passed, but the rules have changed over the years and gotten looser and looser, so that people who are spending literally 95% of their day doing menial work, routine kinds of work, can be exempted under the rules. This is not a rule as currently drafted that applies only to people with advanced learning, professional degrees, or anything of the like.
Is it possible, and I'll get back to you, James, but is it possible, Ross, for the Labor Department to come up with a job description that meets the kind of work, the actual work that people do that would satisfy you?
I think that the Labor Department wants to do that, and the President has directed the Secretary to look at an overhaul of the rules, not just lifting the salary threshold. I'm afraid that is a very complicated right. task that could take a long time. I'd like them to focus on the salary threshold, fix that first, and then look into all of the other aspects of the rule. There's one other thing, this notion that you can spend 95 or 99% of your time doing menial work and still be considered an executive. I think they should address that. And California, for example, has a rule that says you have to spend a majority of your time doing executive or professional work to be considered an executive or a professional. They wouldn't allow you to spend 95% of your time scrubbing floors and yet be considered an executive.
What do you think of that, James Shirk?
Well, the current standard, the way it's written, is that the worker themselves have to be the ones who decide how much time they spend on those, what you call your white-collar executive and managerial tasks, and how much they spend on the other tasks. So you could have, say, an assistant manager at a retail store who spends a lot of their time being a manager, but you know, some days there's just not as much of that work to be done, and they decide, all right, they're going to be one, you know, they'll stock shelves or whatever else needs to be done. I think if what we have currently, where it's the worker themselves, so it can't be someone else, you know, higher up the corporate ladder, so to speak, saying, you know, work 5% of your time on managerial, work 95% on the other. But to qualify for the exemption, I think it's a fairly stringent standard that the worker themselves is the one who decides what time they spend on the managerial and the executive tasks and what time they spend on the other tasks. I'm sure you can get some of those border cases where it's, you know, 5% of the time they're spending it. But I think for the most part, the fairly representative employee would be much more the assistant manager at the retail store who is, in fact, an assistant manager, has real managerial responsibilities. But during some of the downtime, you know, they might be stocking shelves. And I think as long as the control is in the hand of the worker, I think that's a pretty good place to draw the line.
Ross, is the control in the hand of the worker?
It really isn't. In fact, the court cases are very clear, and I imagine that James hasn't read them, but I have read probably 100 of these cases, and they say it's what the employer decides is the most important task that the worker is doing that determines whether the worker is an executive or not. And so it isn't up to the worker. If the job is keeping the store clean, and there, you know, you only have three people and there's enough work for five or six people, then people are going to be doing a lot of overtime work, and they can be they literally can spend 95% of their time. It's not a matter of their choice. They have to do the work. They've been told by their higher-ups that they have to do it, and if they spend their time cleaning floors, they can still be considered an executive under the rule, which is absurd.
James?
Well, again, you go back to the regulations that were passed in 2004, and the standard is that the employee is in control. if the court decisions have gone in ways that were not in the spirit of the regulations, then I don't think there's much opposition to the notion of changing that. But what I would be opposed to would be a stricter sort of hard and fast line. You have to spend 50% plus one of your time, because you're going to have times when the store is very busy and someone's got to help out, and the manager may need to spend some time at the cash register or something like that. Other times when they're going to have more managerial, more the HR tasks, and I don't think you want to have a sort of keeping time with the timekeeper kind of thing. That as long as you've got protections against abuse, as long as I think the worker is the one deciding what's in the best interest of the enterprise and not someone above them, then you avoid that sort of regulatory minutiae.
But what I'm hearing is that from you, James Shirk, that the worker decides, and what I'm hearing from you, Ross Eisenbray, is that it's the worker's boss who decides how they spend their day. Ross?
That's right. I mean, the rule says in explicit terms that whether you're an executive depends on your duty, and the duty that your employer decides is your most important duty is the one that determines whether you're an executive. It does not matter how much time you spend. So literally, the rules are very clear. If you spend 95% of your time doing menial work, but your employer decides that the 5% of your time, not you, you don't get to make this decision about whether you're paid overtime or not. Your employer makes the decision. If only 5% of your time is spent in some supervisory capacity, nevertheless, you are considered an executive under the rule, and you can be denied overtime pay. And to the extent that you can work so many hours that you end up making less than the minimum wage, and yet the law allows you to be considered an exempt executive.
And
this has to be changed.
That is Ross Eisenbray, Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute, joining us by telephone, and James Shirk, Senior Policy Analyst in Labor Economics at the Heritage Foundation, joining us from their studios. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. James, I have a question for you, and I have one for you as well, Ross, and then we'll get to our callers. I'm stealing Damian Paletta's question to you, James Shirk, which is that do you think that companies will, let's say they pay an employee $40,000, they'll reduce their salary to $30,000 and then pay them $10,000 in overtime as a kind of workaround if this rule is changed?
That's exactly what's going to happen. We've already been seeing this happening. You've had a lot of lawsuits that have been launched by the trial lawyers over these overtime issues. And so you've had a lot of companies that are voluntarily reclassifying workers who could arguably be considered exempt from overtime and saying, all right, you know what, we're not even going to contest that. We're simply going to say you qualify for overtime. And in the same breath that they do that, they then cut their base pay so that their end pay is more or less the same. This is exactly what IBM did a few years ago. They had about 7,000 salaried technical and support workers who were making an average of about $77,000 a year, and they turned them into hourly employees but cut their base pay by about 15% so that after the overtime hours, their end-of-year pay was exactly the same. So I don't think we're going to see – I think what we're arguing over basically are a lot of currently salaried employees going to be turned effectively into hourly workers, having to track their time and restrictions and can they telework and work from home and the like. But I don't think their overall pay is going to change much at all. You can force the companies to pay them overtime, but in the same breath, those companies are going to cut the base salaries so that the end pay is going to be exactly the same.
And Ross, assuming that there's some kind of passage on this and that some individuals are paid overtime, that comes out of the bosses or the company's profits, yes?
Yes. Well, there are actually several different routes that an employer could take to deal with this. And despite the one anecdote that James suggested, the one that is probably least likely is the one he suggested. And we have, 75 years of history under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and I don't think there's evidence that that's what happened in the past. We had many salary increases in the past, and it didn't lead to people's wages being cut. In fact, in those years, wages gained strongly across the economy, and it's only in the last 30 or so years when we haven't made these adjustments, that we've seen wages stagnating or actually falling for average workers. But employers have a choice. They can hire somebody else at straight time. They don't have to pay time and a half. They can add to their employment, which would be a good thing right now when we actually have high unemployment. They could raise, if they don't want to take lower pay or profits for themselves, they could pass the costs on to consumers, which, again, is not a terrible thing. We have very low inflation and below the Fed's targets, and a little bit more inflation right now would be a good thing. So I don't think that making this adjustment is going to be any real difficulty for the economy.
Let me get John from media to join our conversation. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are
Great
you?
Show.
Thank you.
I have a question for you about the notion that it would cost jobs. I know I worked in the corporate sector for many years as a vendor. I've been self-employed. But I know a lot of the people that I worked with were sort of in this lower middle management group. And when the recession hit, a lot of people were laid off, and the people that were remaining were forced to do the work of two or three people. And so they went from working 40 to 45 hours a week to working 70 to 80 hours a week. And if those people have to be paid overtime, wouldn't it behoove a corporation to hire back people and have two employees rather than one employee so they're not paying time and a half for the extra 30 hours a week that these people are working?
Well, John, let me see what James Shirk has to say. What do you think?
Well, again, I don't think it's going to affect the company's costs that much at all. I think what we've seen with these Fair Labor Standards Act lawsuits is that when companies basically are required by the courts to reclassify workers as qualifying for overtime, or when they do it voluntarily to avoid a lawsuit, in the same breath, they very often cut workers' pay. It's so that the total pay, including the overtime, works out to being roughly what they had before. Some people might get a little bit more. Some people might get a little bit less. But on average, the workers' pay is unchanged. You've sort of changed around. They're going from being salaried and getting a flat amount of money for the work they're done to now they have to track their hours and keep track of their time, and they're still getting the same amount. So I'd say I don't think the companies are going to hire more workers or lay off workers, because I don't think their costs are going to change that much.
Well, to you, Ross, James has been saying several times he sees the potential impact of this as going from being a salaried employee to an hourly employee, and we're about a minute before our second break. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you can speculate, but he says he has evidence. I have never seen it. I don't think that it's true. Wages are sticky, and employers are not going to drastically cut workers' pay and then expect them to work overtime and be as motivated and as happy as as they were. They won't be as productive, and employers really aren't likely to do that.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about something the president did last week. He directed the Labor Department to update federal rules on overtime pay, overtime for people who are qualified as supervisors or managers or executives. Talking with Ross Eisenbray, vice president of the Economic Policy Institute, and with James Shirk. He's senior policy analyst in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation. Getting two different perspectives. We want to hear from you, your perspective. That phone number. Number again, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Bryn Athyn College, quality liberal arts in a spiritual setting since 1877. Details at 267-728-4218 or brynathyn.edu.
It was a huge mess, you know, that old Big Bang. Is that mess still detectable? Is the gravitational energy that keeps us stuck to the Earth an echo from 4 billion years ago, give or take a trillionth of a second? Gravity's waves from the Big Bang's ripples. We'll explain everything next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show has brought together patrons and artisans for 20 years. This year's show takes place at the 23rd Street Armory just north of Chestnut Street and runs from Friday evening, April 4th to Sunday the 6th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, textiles, lighting, and tabletop items. PIFS supports WHYY. Info at philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Art you can live with.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for Your Business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at pico.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain talking about whether or not to rewrite overtime pay rules. And again, talking with James Shirk and Ross Eisenbray, and calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. James Shirk, let me go back to you. I mean, how do you propose then to reward productivity, a loyalty to a company, if you don't pay someone overtime or reward them for the extra hours that they work during during a work week, whether it's 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week?
Well, I think that most salaried employees, the way they see these the rewards, so they get raises and they get promotions. And that's how you reward hard work, and that's how you reward and encourage productivity. But I think if you've got someone who's currently salaried and is working, say, an average of 45 hours a week and is getting paid $45,000 a year, the government can pass these overtime changes, but at the end of them, the worker is still going to be getting paid $5,000 a year and working 45 hours a week. They can more or less convert that worker to an hourly employee and work at the overtime rates, and that's what a lot of these companies have done in response. At the end of the day, the worker's pay is not going to go down, but it's not going to go up any. I mean, the way this overtime argument is being presented is, here's a great way we can give millions of workers a raise. Would that it were that simple. But the employers pay workers for the value of the work they're producing, their productivity. The productivity hasn't changed any. Then they're simply going to rejigger how they provide the compensation in order to come up with the same end figure at the end of the day.
What do you think, Ross, that in lieu of changing overtime, using raises and promotions as a way of rewarding hard work?
Well, employers do already and will continue to give people raises even when they're paid overtime. The fact that you're paid overtime doesn't mean you can't get a promotion. I'm not sure what the relationship is that James is suggesting. I don't think it makes a difference how you're paid, whether you might get a promotion or not. I think the important thing to remember is that the 40-hour work week that we think that we have, it's a construct of the overtime law itself. If we didn't require that employers pay time and a half for overtime, we would be back where we were in the 1930s before the law passed, when it didn't cost them anything much more to have someone work 50 hours or 60 hours than 40. The whole notion of the 40-hour work week really comes out of the notion of an 8-hour day and a 40-hour work week. The weekend is a construct that comes from paying people for their overtime, making it more expensive for employers to work people long hours. And it worked in the past. I think it will continue to work in the future.
Let me give you a chance to respond to that, James Shirk. Are you opposed to the 40-hour work week? Then we'll get to our callers.
Well, I think for a lot of professional employees, they really value the flexibility to basically get paid for getting the job done and getting the work done. We're seeing with modern technology, with telecommuting, that it is possible for people to work from home. And a lot of workers want that flexibility. If you've got a working parent who'd like to be able to take a few hours off in the middle of the day, you go check up on their child or take the child to a doctor's visit, come back, and then work from home in the evening when that your child has gone to sleep, a lot of parents value that flexibility. But if you turn everyone into an hourly employee who's got to be tracking their minutes rigorously, companies are going to crack down on that. There's USA Today was reporting last week that the HR Policy Association did a survey of 155 large firms. And what they found was that 56 said that they've curbed the use of communications devices like iPhones and BlackBerries, and that a majority have restricted the use of telecommuting because of these overtime lawsuits. Well, I think actually a lot of professional and salaried employees like being able to telecommute and have the flexibility to plan their day according to their family's needs, not according to, all right, now you're on the clock, now you're off the clock, that sort of timekeeping minutia.
I'd like you to respond to that, Ross, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Well, I think that what people want is to be fairly compensated. And if you're an executive or an attorney making, you know, let's say $100,000 or $150,000 a year, you're in one category. You do sort of control your time, and your employer certainly should have faith in you that you're working when you say you're working. But people who are making $25,000, $30,000, $35,000, $40,000 a year are barely getting by. And to require them to be paid as little as they are, and then to work 20 extra hours in a week for no pay, I think is just wrong. It's not good for the economy. It's not the flexibility that they're looking for. Most people don't want to work 60 hours a week, but if their employer can make them work 60 hours a week without paying them anything additional for the added 20 hours, employers will do it, and that doesn't help the employees at all.
Let me get Chris from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
It's a great conversation. I just wanted to make a point about the idea of switching people from salary to hourly. I own four retail outlets, and I have a manager at each one that is a salaried manager. While I certainly agree that raising the lower end, you know, someone who's making $24,000 a year and is salaried, I think that definitely needs to be increased, and I support a living wage and those kind of things. At the upper end, my starting out managers are going to be in that $40,000 to $50,000 range, and I can tell you that absolutely if this change came about and the threshold was raised to that amount, I would without question change those salary guys to hourly and adjust their pay so that the end of the week, I expect them to work about 46 hours a week, they're making exactly the same amount that they would under previously when they were salaried. And so, I think there is a line there, but I just wanted to lend credence to one side of the argument that absolutely I would do that because I don't know that I could absorb a significant change like that all at once. I would definitely make that change.
Chris, a quick question. Do they typically work, your managers, do they typically work about 46 hours a week?
Yes. Yeah, and I am not in a case, where I don't know what they're doing, where they're working from home or anything like that. They're always at the retail outlet, so it's fairly easy for me to track their hours.
Well, let me give Ross Eisenbray a chance to respond to your comment. This is an anecdote, but this is a guy that has four retail stores here in the Delaware Valley.
Well, he says that he's paying them $40,000 to $50,000 a year already, and that's about the level that we're talking about. I'm suggesting $50,000 would put us back where we were in the 1970s. Not taking into account the greater wealth of the nation, but I think at that level, there's a line somewhere, and if it's at $45,000 a year, where he wouldn't do that, where he'd leave people as salaried workers, maybe that's the line that we should be drawing. But this is something that. I should remind everyone the Labor Department hasn't chosen a figure yet.
No, they haven't.
They won't do that until later in the year. This is just the proposal that I've made, not the president's proposal.
And you're talking, I think, $970 a week, something like that?
Yeah, with inflation, I'd say $984 a week. It's essentially $51,000, $52,000 a year, something like that.
Chris, I appreciate the call. James, did you want to add to that?
Well, I would second what Ross said. We don't know what the president's going to propose. If you were to propose, say, $30,000 a year, then that's not something that I'd have much of a concern with. But, again, think of someone, say, who's a reporter covering that special election we had last week. You know, they're going to be, and in many cases, or a blogger. If you're in a lower cost of living part of the country, if you're in Tennessee, if you're in Alabama, a lot of those entry-level salaried positions are going to start you around high 30s or low 40,000s a year. Does that reporter or that blogger necessarily want to be tracking all the time they're spending reading news about the election? All the, you know, the time they stay up watching the election results to the minute? Those are the sorts of, you know, timekeeping things that a lot of professional employees don't want to deal with. What he wants to be able to do is watch the election results, write up the blog post, you're summarizing it, and you know, not have to see, all right, here's my timesheet, here's when I was on, here's when I was off, make sure that I'm not working any more than, you know, X amount of hours next week. But a lot of these entry-level salary employees, they're not going to see a pay increase, as the caller indicated. Their pay is simply going to be adjusted so that they had what they had before, but they're going to have to track their hours in great detail. They're not going to be able to telecommute. It's going to be quite a nuisance for a lot of workers.
But it's an entry-level person. They're not a manager, though, are they?
There's a lot of entry-level salaried employees. There's basically three different, if you're executive, if you're administrative, or if you're professional. So someone like a blogger working for a website would qualify under the professional exemption as long as they exercised a degree of creative judgment. So I think that makes a lot of sense. But at the same time, you know, does someone who's a blogger really want to be told, no, you've got to clock exactly your hours when you're working on a story and an idea? What happens when an idea for a blog comes to you in the middle of the night? Are you supposed to, you know, you start tracking the time you spent working on that then? You know, spent a half hour thinking about it. I mean, it's for a lot of these professional jobs, being an hourly employee doesn't make very much sense. And to say that everyone nationwide who makes less than $50,000 a year has to track their hours, I think would be an immense burden on a lot of workers.
But your thesis is that if this happens and goes to a much higher threshold than it is today, that all these salaried workers would become hourly workers. I mean, that's...
Well, their companies, they might keep you on a salary, but they have to track your hours. Because if you qualify for overtime, they're going to face a lawsuit, basically, if they don't pay you time and a half. So they could keep you salaried.
Right.
But whether you're officially salaried or officially hourly, they're going to have to just keep track of your hours. And a lot of companies have already started doing things like restricting telecommuting for workers who are arguably not exempt from overtime.
Do you see that, Ross?
I think that James is nibbling around the edges. He's talking about a tiny subset of the workers, of the millions, 10 million workers who would be affected by the increase that I'm talking about, most of whom are people who are like working in insurance companies. They're at a desk all day. These are not people who are teleworking or doing anything like it. They're filing insurance claims and processing insurance claims. And because the rules have changed over the years, suddenly they're considered overtime exempt. But if you had a bright line test that said, no, if you make less than $50,000 a year, you would be paid overtime when you're at your desk for an extra 20 hours in the week doing these, filling out these insurance claims and processing them, that would be a real boon. There are way more people who we're talking about than bloggers. I mean, he's talking about a fractional subset of the people we're talking about, people working in nursing homes and hospitals and businesses all across the country, bank employees, bookkeepers, who should be paid for their overtime. They're not. There's no flexibility in their life at all. They're required to be at work at 9 o'clock. If they're late, that's a demerit for them, and they clock out on the clock, even though they're not paid for their overtime.
Let me get
to that's who we're really talking about.
Let me get to Mike from Haddon Township in New Jersey to join us. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm a retired human resource person, so I had a little experience with this. I happen to agree with Ross. I think Ross is on the right track here. I think there's a couple of reasons why cutting people's pay, it may not be a good idea. I think, first of all, you're going to create a desire for unionization, which a lot of employers don't want. So I think if they go around cutting people's pay in order to keep pay the same, I think that may be counterproductive. Second of all, there's trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines of our economy. So the idea that we can't afford this, I think, is a straw man. Now, maybe for certain small employers, you have to have some exemptions, but I think generally speaking, this is very affordable. And I think a third benefit, a third point, and a benefit of this proposal, if it does increase overall wages, is that we need more money to go into the Social Security pot to protect Social Security. And this is a good way to get more money into the Social Security pot.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. James Shirk, go ahead. Your response. We have about a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye.
Well, I think where workers get upset and would consider unionizing and the like would be if their overall pay goes down. But if they're working the same hours they were before and, say, bringing in an $800 a week check, same as before, I don't think that if you're just sort of rejiggering how the pay is calculated, what they care about is the check they take home at the end of the week. And if that doesn't change, I don't think you're going to see the sort of blowback he's concerned about. But what we have seen in response to the existing HR lawsuits of the companies that have reclassified workers, as the previous caller mentioned, how he would respond is simply companies change their pay practices. The overall pay remains the same. The workers aren't going to get a raise. I mean, it's, you know, would that the world were that simple. But the workers aren't going to be seeing their pay go up. What they're going to see is that they all have to track their hours. And the problem with a federal one-size-fits-all rule is that, look, I just gave one example before about bloggers.
Only because we have 30 seconds, and I just want to give Ross a chance to respond to our caller as well. What our caller was saying is that he thinks this would be good for the overall economy.
Yeah, every dollar that you shift from profits to higher wages is good for the economy, for the reason he said that people would pay more into Social Security. That would be a good thing. That it would increase demand in the economy, which would be a good thing. That would lead to more goods being produced and services rendered, and would lead to higher employment. Those are great things. I think the caller hit the nail on the head.
Well, we could go on. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Ross Eisenbray, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And he's Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute. And James Shirk, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A senior policy analyst in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation. And we began our conversation with Damian Paletta from the Wall Street Journal. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to continue this conversation. Also, check us out on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter and you can download podcasts. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.